I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Usually on the day before Thanksgiving, we do a show about being together with family and friends and offer tips about cooking that celebratory meal. But the pandemic has upended that holiday tradition. It's been months of lockdowns and losses and stresses, which can take its toll on our body, our psyche, even our soul. So today in Radio Times, how to take care of yourself during the pandemic and beyond, finding whole body health in these extraordinary times. Our guest is Dr. Daniel Monti. He's founding director and CEO of the Marcus Institute of Integrative Health at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia. He's founding chair in the Department of Integrative Medicine and Nutritional Sciences at the Sidney Kimmel Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University. And he joins us to discuss an integrative medicine approach to well-being. His new book, co-authored with Dr. Anthony Bazan, is titled Tapestry of Health. And Dr. Daniel Monti, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
So great to be back here with you, Marty.
Well, let's start with a broad-based question. And my question to you, and you have worked as a psychiatrist, you're not a practicing psychiatrist now, but whether we feel the symptoms or not, can we assume that we are all under some degree of stress because of the pandemic?
Yes, absolutely. The pandemic creates uncertainty. It creates issues in people's lives that they've never had to face before. And everybody is feeling it to some degree. And sometimes it catches up on you when you don't realize it, because you tell yourself, I'm doing fine. I'm coping just fine. But it's natural and normal to react to something stressful like a pandemic where there's uncertainty in the environment.
Really, go ahead. Finish your thought. Sorry.
I was just going to say that, you know, our nervous system is constructed in a way that this is going to be stressful. We have these two branches of the autonomic nervous system people might have heard of before, sympathetic and parasympathetic, or an easier way of thinking about it is fight or flight and restoration and recuperation. That fight or flight part of the nervous system gets activated when there's anything in the environment that we perceive, consciously or not, to be a threat to our well-being in some way. So something like what's going on now is going to do that for most people, practically everybody. And what happens when that fight or flight mechanism gets set off, it affects everything from how well we sleep at night to how well we digest food to our outlook on life. And it affects our coping. It even affects our immune system.
I was reading from dentists, actually, that they're finding that more people are grinding their teeth when they're sleeping at night, just picking up on what you just said there.
Exactly, to that point about sleep, because when we're in that fight or flight mode, which many of us aren't even aware of, it expresses itself, it manifests itself in so many different ways. So sleeping, which is a time to restore, recuperate, heal, mend the body, often gets disrupted by being in this fight or flight mode in the nervous system. And so teeth grinding is a sign of the stress that people are under.
I don't know about you, but I find I talk, not just on the radio, but I talk about this pandemic almost all day long with almost everyone that I interact with, whether you know, I'm in a masked up at a supermarket picking up some yogurt or something. Does talking about it, does that help deal with our stress?
It does, because talking about it is an opportunity for us to connect with others. And one of the things that happens when we get in a distressed place is many people tend to isolate and to connect less with others. It's a normal mechanism, but one that we have to try to bypass, like the other mechanisms that go off at a time of chronic stress like this. On the other hand, there is an overindulgence in information gathering that can be less helpful. So when there's uncertainty, like in times of a pandemic, the brain seeks to get more information so that it can solve the dilemma. right now, there's not an immediate solution. There's things on the horizon. There's things that are happening. But it does sort of cause some people to spend too much of their day sifting through news and trying to find a solution through hours of cable network news or so on, where the solution isn't there. There's not, you know, new news of the day, but their brain is seeking it. And it actually increases the anxiety for some people to sort of overindulge. I know many people, and I've had many patients come through the office and now telehealth, which is more common. And I say, you know, well, be caught up on the news, but, you know, at some point, take a step away from it and engage with people in other ways, and also do some of the stress reduction techniques that we talk about in integrative medicine and, of course, in the book.
Sure, and I do want to get to all that. One of the things that you do write in the book is that our emotions react faster than our thought processes. Help us understand how that affects our overall health.
Absolutely. It's such an important point. So back to that fight or flight part of the nervous system. You know, think about back in the day, you're in the jungle, and out of the corner of your eye, you see a lion in the distance. You don't want to think about mobilizing yourself. You don't want that to be some, do I protect myself? You want the body to get into fight or flight mode without thinking. And so that is actually the emotional or limbic part of the brain that's mobilizing us. The lion, and so if between flight and fight and flight, if you're smart, you might choose flight.
Sure.
Climb up a tree, the
sure.
lion passes, and your nervous system can reset itself. The problem with the present day situation is that the lion of yesterday is the pandemic of today, the worry about financial issues, job security, a parent or loved one who is more at risk for the virus, homeschooling your kids, et cetera, et cetera.
All of that added up together. So what is the integrative model for health? How are we supposed to understand that approach to our well-being, our physical, emotional health?
So our integrative model, and the reason that we're part of a medical school, which is a historic first we're thrilled about, is really what is the value add to the medical model that's out there? Because what my colleagues do in other departments of medicine is terrific. They save lives. They do wonderful things. But what gets missed in that model, which is very disease-focused, is maximizing healthfulness and wellness, particularly as we think about a time like this. What can we best be doing for our own personal resilience to weather the storm that we're in, being as healthy as possible and as resilient to all of the stressors and threats that are out there? And so in that model, we think about everything, body, mind, spirit, community, and all of these things affect health. So on the biological end, of course, there's, you know, if somebody needs a medication, you know, we have a prescription pad. But
sure.
We think a lot about diet, nutrition, nutrient-based therapies that are going to support people. Many of our clinical trials are focused on that. But in terms of our practical advice to people, it's about having a nutritive diet that's going to keep inflammation as low as possible, because inflammation is up during times of stress and just up during living in this world. And also then, how do we weather stress? What are the proven stress reduction strategies that are out there? There's many. We focus on the ones that we've studied a lot and that there's a lot of supportive data behind. Even learning how to breathe a little bit every day can make a huge difference. And people listening might say, well, wait, I breathe. But actually, if you pay attention to your breathing, even if you do it right now, you might notice just in paying attention, you take a deeper breath, a more rhythmic breath, because in times of stress, we tend to hold our breath and have short halting breaths, and we don't even know it until we pay attention to it. And then there's other mind-body strategies, and people can sort of choose where they want to start. That's the other thing. I like to tell people that don't be all or nothing with yourself. Don't feel like you have to do everything or it's a failure, because every little step you take to get your nervous system back into a healthier place, to get your physiology into a healthier place by breaking some habits that you might have gotten into during the pandemic of overindulging in junky food and things like that, and adding some more nutritive supportive foods to your diet. Every little thing you do makes a difference in that mind-body architecture. And then paying attention to sleep, which you mentioned earlier on, that's a big one for us. We have a chapter on sleep hygiene, and I'm often asked, what does that word mean, sleep hygiene? Yeah. And the sleep doctors like that word, but it really means sleep habits. What are your sleep habits, and have they kind of gone in the wrong direction during this stressful time? Because for many people, they have. There's this blurred boundary between work and home, and the bedroom sort of becomes also a work room, and everything is happening, and it actually interferes with that biorhythm that's so important for resetting the nervous system. So it's really taking an overall approach. And then for the spiritual part, we don't necessarily mean religious, although if you find kind of your spiritual self in religion, that's great. But it's for us, spirituality means finding meaning in something outside of ourselves. And that could be artistic expression, that could be music, that could be religious practices, it could be meditation. But we need to sort of disconnect from us and connect to something beyond us.
Let me pick up on all of that, but I'll start first, and we're almost up on a break here, so I'll do it very quickly. Having to do with diet and reading through your book, it's largely plant-based diet. That seems to be, from your perspective, the most healthy approach. Now, a lot of people they're just not going to give up their meat. They're not going to give up their chicken. What are the sort of basic plants that should be part of our diet in 30 seconds, 60 seconds or less?
Yes, I'll start with the beautiful point you made. We focus on not giving up things, but adding things. And over time, your body begins to resonate with the things that it feels good consuming. And so plants, if it grows, it's good, with some exceptions, maybe hallucinogenic mushrooms or something. But basically, the phytonutrients from plants are so important. Also, adding healthy fat to the diet is so important, and it's anti-inflammatory. So we hear about those omega-3 fatty acids. Those are great, but also the omega-9s that we get from, say, olive oil and avocados. So adding healthy fat and plants wherever you can. If you can substitute what you've been doing for lunch for a fresh, healthy salad, great. If you're able to make a smoothie in the morning or any time during the day, great. Adding those phytonutrients to the diet nourishes the body, because a lot of the other foods that people are eating do not.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Daniel Monte, and he is co-author of a new book called Tapestry of Health, weaving wellness into your life through the new science of integrative medicine, and joining us on Radio Times to walk us through some of the advice in the book. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain, and we're talking about what steps we can take to manage our mental and physical health during the stresses of the pandemic and beyond. Our guest is Dr. Daniel Monte. He's founding chair of the Department of Integrative Medicine and Nutritional Sciences at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. In fact, it's a first-of-its-kind department affiliated with a medical school, and he is co-author of a new book called Tapestry of Health, based on some of the principles of integrative medicine. And you can join us, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. You were talking about food that are high in good fats, olive oil, safflower oil, Brazil nuts, almonds, flax seeds, pumpkin seeds, avocado, and salmon. You also talk about the dirty dozen and the clean 15. What are the dirty dozen?
So when we talk about things like that, it has to do with the pesticides that these foods absorb. And it's just a reality that in agriculture, pesticides are prevalent, and some plants really suck them in if they're not organically farmed, and other plants are a little more resilient to them. And so that's what we're talking about with them. And some of the common ones include things like cucumbers and grapes, for example, strawberries. These are things that people see in the supermarket all the time. And for those, I say, listen, I understand that organic produce costs more, and that's why we sort of parse it out in the book like that. But there's certain things that if you want the treat of strawberries, I say, if you can get them organic, get them organic. Mm. We're exposed to enough chemicals and toxins that we can't control. So when I know that something is going to be high in those things, we like to point it out in the book and when we're talking to our patients so that they can minimize extra toxins.
You talk about the Clean 15, and these are largely vegetables. I would say a couple of fruits that can at least sustain a certain amount of pesticides or fertilizer residue, beginning with avocados, sweet corn, pineapples, cabbage, frozen sweet peas, onions, asparagus, and mangoes. That's about the first half of the list. So these are foods that you can at least, I guess, in moderation buy and not worry about them being organic. But I'm wondering about, you know, for a lot of people, there are these food deserts where it's hard to find fresh fruits and vegetables. What do you suggest for those people?
Yeah, this is a big problem, and it's something that I think a lot about. And I work with some people at Jefferson who are doing groundbreaking research and programs to help people in the Philadelphia area. And I know people are doing this throughout the country. And we have a relationship with Philabundance, for example. And we're trying to study this problem and improve upon this problem. I think that there's an increasing number of resources for people to get produce, but there's not enough.
Yeah.
And it's really a problem because when people don't have access to just some clean, healthy food, I don't even worry about the organic, non-organic in some of these places, just to get produce, to be able to have the fiber, that natural fiber in your diet so that you can support the good bacteria in the gut, is so critical and so essential. It's just there's a huge disparity there, and it's something that we think a lot about, and we try to help with the problem as best we can. So I tell people who have, you know, more limited access to think about what is out there in terms of resources and to try to access some of the resources that are out there for the community so that at least a couple of times a week you can get some of that living food. You know, if we kind of think about where our energy comes from, plants get their energy from the sun, photosynthesis. If you're taking a biology class, we don't walk outside and say, "Hey, sun." It doesn't work like that for us, although that's how we get our vitamin D. We get our energy from the plants. When we eat an animal, it's another step removed. And I'm not saying you have to be vegan, but I think some of that fresh, living energy from plants is important. And it's important to do it as much as you can. Some people have the ability to do it all the time. Some people have more limited resources. I think the more you think about it and the more it becomes a focus, the more it's doable, because we do have programs for underserved patients, and people can find a way to do it if they think about it. And, you know, we're here to help them do that.
What do you think about frozen vegetables and fruits? Does that
serve?
Great
question. Frozen vegetables are fine. They're a step removed from the fresh ones. Mm-hmm. The frozen fruits, I would caution people on. There was a large population-based study that showed the more fresh vegetables and fruits that you ate, the better your overall health outcomes were. And the relationship reversed itself when you went to canned and for some fruits frozen, because there's a preservative process when they can or freeze some of those fruits. Canned in general loses most of its nutritional value, and they often put chemicals or super high heating in the process of canning. So I would say that frozen is a good middle ground for vegetables, and I would focus it on vegetables.
Speaking of vegetables, you talk about cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, yeah. cauliflower, kale, Brussels sprouts, cabbage. I mean, these are vegetables I associate with kind of winter vegetables. Are they healthier than the more kind of summery squash, tomato vegetables that we associate with warm weather?
They're different. And, I think in the warm weather, too, the leafy greens and the leafy greens whenever, because those leafy greens have just some phenomenal phytonutrients in them, things that are really helpful for us. Those cruciferous vegetables that you just mentioned have additional value to them, particularly, I underscore them in some of our chapters about people entering those middle decades of life and yes. are maybe struggling with hormonal issues and balancing circulating sex hormones, because if people are aromatizing too much, and what that means is converting, say a man is converting too much of his precious little declining testosterone into estrogen, it could be a diet-related and also a body weight-related issue that cruciferous vegetables can help with because of some of the important phytonutrients that they have. So they balance hormones. They have many other important phytonutrient values to them as well. So I like a variety. Some root vegetables are too sugary to eat too many of. Like it's fine to have a couple of carrots a day. It's probably not okay to juice two bags of carrots a day. That's the thing about juicing. We prefer making a smoothie with the whole plant. And then the leafy greens are just tremendous. And then the cruciferous vegetables, which are its own kind of thing. And you mentioned kale. Kale's available, all year long. And,
sure.
and when you make a salad, sometimes you can break it up with some types of lettuces with kale and other types of things that you might want to put in it.
One of the things you also say that if for the carnivores, for the meat eaters, eat your meat with a green vegetable. Why green?
Yes. So what you want to do is minimize the starchiness and carbohydrate that you're taking in with the meat so that you digest it better. We know that, and this is an old technique, that digestion goes better if you're going to consume some meat, to do it with a green, low-carbohydrate vegetable. So steam some broccoli, which is a cruciferous one, or have a salad. And the other nice thing about that is you can also balance the fats. So if you're having a healthy salad or some vegetables that you kind of douse in some olive oil and lemon, the fat from the olive oil balances to some degree the fat from the meat, because that meat has a lot of fat that's harmful, and both fats compete for the same receptor sites on cells. So we want to, when we're consuming the not great stuff, to consume it with the good stuff. And I think this is a concept that people often miss. There's something about dieting in America where people become all or nothing in their thought process. And I think you're going to be most successful if you're constantly thinking about how do I balance things? How do I take in extra of the good things, which then all on its own will decrease some of the intake of the not so good things.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Dr. Daniel Monti. He's founding chair of the Department of Integrative Medicine and Nutritional Sciences at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. Also co-author of a new book that we're talking about called Tapestry of Health, Weaving Wellness into Your Life Through the New Science of Integrative Medicine. And we wanted to do this program because we feel as if we are all under some degree of stress and thinking about how to maintain a healthy or even healthier lifestyle. And again, you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. There have been a number of reports recently, essentially warnings about the hyping of vitamin B, vitamin C to improve COVID-19 outcomes. And I know you have been doing some research looking at some of these vitamins. What do we need to know?
Right. I think one of the things we need to know is that there's a difference between a clinical trial that's in progress and recommendations for what you do in your daily life. I think that what happens is some people see that, or it gets announced that a clinical trial is going on, and so the assumption is, then I better load up on that thing, when the whole point of the trial is to see if there's a therapeutic effect. And also, what we're doing in the hospital is very different than what life is like as an outpatient. So for our clinical trial of vitamin C, which I'm doing in partnership with the Department of Infectious Diseases, with Dr. Dagan Kopach at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, when people come into the hospital with COVID, so they're sick enough that they have to be hospitalized, we are looking at what the effect of high-dose vitamin C infusions is, because in that group of people, we think that there could be, and that's what we're testing, we're about two-thirds of the way through the study, a therapeutic advantage in terms of activating the immune system for people who are having a sluggish enough response that they need to be hospitalized. And hopefully this will lead to less ICU admissions and getting people home to continue their recovery quicker. This is different because the way we're using the vitamin C in this clinical trial is really as a drug. We're infusing it, which gives it a different response in the body than when you take it orally. You can't actually get the kind of response that we get infusing it by taking it orally. It's just simply not possible. So that's one thing I like to demystify right from the beginning. Now, that said, we should all be consuming a sufficient amount of vitamin C that we're in a healthy state, that we're not deficient of it because the immune system does use it, but so does practically every other system of the body. It's an important, that's why it's an essential nutrient. We generally can get enough vitamin C through a healthy diet. Not everybody's going to eat those things, though. We all know that citrus fruits, certain vegetables, bell peppers, things like that, are high in vitamin C. I often tell people, remember, fresh lemons this time of year, squeeze it in your tea, squeeze it on your salad, squeeze it on things because, lemon has a nice amount. And for those of you who are cooks, and you like to sort of, grate a little bit of the rind of an orange or a lemon, don't forget, actually, the rind has a good amount of vitamin C. So there's ways of getting in enough. For people who say, yeah, but I'm probably not going to do any of that. Should I take a little extra? If you take a multivitamin, there's enough in that. And if you don't and you want to take a little extra, that's fine. But loading up on mega doses, you're probably just going to give yourself a little gastrointestinal distress if you do that.
Aren't you going to kind of pee it out in the end?
That's exactly what happens, or the other way.
Right. That's what our body does.
The other nutrient that I tell people to just be sufficient, again, not mega dose, is vitamin D. D is in dog, because there has been some reports. And again, when reports are small, we don't know, they're not definitive, they're not conclusive. But in COVID and in other respiratory illnesses, that if people are very deficient of vitamin D, that it takes them longer to get over the infection. And it's because that makes sense. Vitamin D is needed for some of those responses for healing and recovery. But again, it doesn't mean take mega doses of D. It means just make sure you have enough.
I'm thinking and this is a question more about our healthcare system and in our overall health. We know that chronic diseases are a problem here. It does put people at risk for a whole host of illnesses, including COVID-19. We spend, more on our health per person than any other country in the world. Do we get a return on that kind of investment from your perspective?
This is the perfect statement of why we created a Department of Integrative Medicine, because as you just stated, not only do we spend more than any other country, you could make the argument that we have some of the best medicine in the world in the United States. People come from all around to learn our surgical techniques, our pharmacologic advancements, biotech, and when you tease out even access for underserved populations, what you're still left with is an unhealthy population because there's a disconnect between health and wellness and disease. So we're good at treating disease. We're not so great with health and wellness. And the problem is you can't disconnect the two. Both have to be integrated. So here we have arguably the best medicine in the world. We spend the most on medicine in the world, and yet we don't make the top 10 list for healthy life expectancy for women or men. In fact, our health status is such that the World Health Organization places us at about 37th in the world. So that disconnect is clearly there. And it's not just there among people, it's even there in the healthcare system, which is one of the things we're trying to address.
Well, there are even these things called diseases of despair now in the United States, where we're seeing among certain populations of the country that the lifespan is actually decreasing as opposed to increasing, which it has done through most of the 20th century. These diseases of despair, often about anxiety and depression, but it can show up in people's physical health.
That's absolutely correct. We have not just a disconnect in health and wellness, but we're a disconnected population. That's why one of the things that I talk to people about in my practice and in the book is, and during stressful times like this, to stay as connected to others as possible, because the disconnect increases the despair. The other thing that's a huge problem is something that you mentioned before, which is this: these food deserts, or even if they're, somebody doesn't live in a food desert, their behavior is as if they do. I have a friend, for example, who is an emergency room physician in an area of the country where it's sort of a food desert, the whole place. And it's just kind of the culture to eat lots of fast food, junky food, and to really not take in a nutritive diet. And so people have a lot of comorbidities by the time they're 45, 50 years old.
Well, you know what, and Dr. Monty? Yeah, hold on to that. Yeah. Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break. That's okay. We will be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
With us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you are just joining us, our guest is Dr. Daniel Monty. He's founding chair of the Department of Integrative Medicine and Nutritional Sciences at Thomas Jefferson University. That's in Philadelphia, and again, co-author of a new book called Tapestry of Health, and it's based on some of the principles of integrative medicine built around healthy food, healthy lifestyles. And you can join us. You can send us an email. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Dr. Monty, you were talking before the break about how even if we don't live in a food desert, we often act like we do because we eat a lot of processed and packaged foods.
Yeah, and one of the things that we've noticed is that it has an effect on people's morbidities early in life. By that I mean the illnesses they developed, from high blood pressure to type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome. And we know this makes people more vulnerable for when an infectious disease comes along like COVID. So in areas of the country where this is a big problem, we do see younger people have more of a problem with the disease than if people had a more resilient lifestyle.
What about the role, and we've got some comments here, I do want to weave them into our conversation, but what about the role of genetics? I think we all know people who live healthy lives, they eat well, they exercise, they do all the things you probably prescribe in your book, and they get heart disease or they get cancer. How do we understand that?
That's absolutely true. So we're this combination of nature and nurture, and we all grew up, you know, what is that relationship? And the one simple way of thinking about the relationship is that we have this set of genes that we were born with, and how they express themselves has to do with two things, to keep it simple. One, how they're programmed, and so that would be the vulnerabilities that we have. But then two, and this is where we have control, is what we expose those genes to, because how those genes express themselves have a lot to do with the environment, and that's nutrients, food, lack of nutrients, stress, lack of stress, toxins, all of those kinds of things. And so it is a combination. Sometimes there is just a strong genetic programming that we can't outdo with environmental influence. But a lot of times, what we do can affect genetic expression enough to make a big difference. And even in those people where they still develop the heart disease, by doing those good things, how severe the heart disease is often very different than if they just threw in the towel and said, well, I'm not going to bother with diet, nutrition, and those kinds of things. So what we do still makes a difference. I often like to use the metaphor of keys on a keyboard. So the genes, we'll call them the keys. And then the player is you and everything that you expose those genes to. So the keyboard matters for the quality of sound. If we put two pianos in the room, my grandmother's old upright piano from childhood and a Steinway grand piano, and we put me at the Steinway grand piano with my failed years of piano lessons, and we bring Horowitz or Mozart back from the dead and put him at my grandmother's old upright piano, that's going to be some more beautiful music than I can create on that Steinway. So the genes matter, but how we play those genes matters tremendously.
Phyllis asks, what's the latest on butter, good or bad? The science around saturated fat seems to be changing.
Yeah, I feel sorry for most people.
I love butter, I have to say, but yes, no, go ahead.
Who have to deal with this ongoing thing because, you know, is butter good? Is it bad? Yeah. You know, so I would say that butter is better than some of the commercially made fats that actually are very inflammatory. But butter is not a health food. I think that butter has to be in moderation because it's still saturated. And so if you have overall good cardiovascular function and you don't have heart disease, you can have a little bit of butter here or there. Is olive oil better? Sure, it is. Are the omega-3 fats better? Sure. I put avocado on my toast this morning instead of butter because I know that it's better. But every once in a blue moon, I like a little butter and I have good cardiovascular function. So I think it's all a matter of just being kind of balanced about this and understanding what the butter is. The butter is a saturated fat, but it's not as inflammatory, and so it's not great for you. But it's not as inflammatory as some of the other artificial stuff is out there, like the old margarines, for example, that, you know, really were kind of toxic.
I remember those margarines well. Here's an email from Jody. Says, can you talk about the benefits of well-raised animal foods, at least B12 and concentrated nutrients? Does a well-raised and, I guess, humanely raised animal, are they actually a healthier animal for those people that eat animals?
Yeah, we think so. There have been some studies that suggest that that's the case. We know, for example, from one study that I like to show if I'm giving a presentation to the medical students or others, is that the healthiness of the fat has gotten exponentially worse in animals over the past 50 years.
Wow.
And that's just based upon, you know, looking at what the content is. And so what I like to do is I show this slide of a cow out in the field eating grass, and I'm like, what is this cow doing that, you know, his or her fat just keeps getting worse and worse and worse as the decades go by? And then I show a picture of what commercial livestock really looks like, which is cows all penned in, eating things that they really weren't engineered to be eating, like corn byproducts and things like that, that are not really the same as eating fresh grass. And this has an effect on what the flesh is like. And on top of that, in commercial livestock, many of them are given a ton of antibiotics because they're not in healthy conditions. And on top of that, the antibiotics create a heavier animal. That's a whole relationship with the gut and the microbiome and all of that that creates that, which is why we're very cognizant of the gut microbiome when we're talking about weight to our patients. And so at the end of the day, you have an animal that is less healthy than what the animals used to be, and the content of the fat and how inflammatory it is, and that inflammation is so important for our health and well-being. So we believe that if something is humanely raised, and I think, you know, what our viewer is saying, you know, like some free range, if it's a cow, it's eating grass, if it's a chicken, it's walking around eating seed, that is a healthier animal than for us to eat. Now, I still think we have to be moderate about that and focus on plants. But when we're thinking about making choices, and if we have the luxury of making that choice between the humanely raised animal or not, I think that is a healthier animal to eat.
I remember doing an interview a couple of years ago about the growing size of the dinner plate, and that if you looked at a dinner plate from, let's say, the 1950s when I was a kid, you know, it was maybe 8 inches or so. And now when you look at a dinner plate, it might be 12 inches. Are we just literally eating too much food?
We are. And we're eating too much of the wrong food. And so you could even have the larger dinner plate, but if you made 3/4 of it plants, and even if you wanted, you know, for that wedge, things like meat or other things that, you know, aren't as ideal as a fresh, healthy plant, you would still be fine. The problem is that expanding plate is expanding with a lot of things like processed foods, things that are laden with chemicals and unhealthy inflammatory fat.
You had talked earlier, and I just wanted to pick up on this, about sleep, and you mentioned the fact that many people are, you know, working from home or working out of their bedroom, which sort of separates that perhaps imaginary or invisible wall between work and home. But nonetheless, how important is getting, 6, 7, 8 hours of, let's call it, uninterrupted sleep? How important is that to our overall health?
It's critical, Marty. I think that most people, from all of the studies that have been done, and you know, everything we say is guided by the evidence. What's the latest evidence? What's the most compelling evidence? And so when we talk about sleep and sleep hygiene, it's what does the data tell us? And the data tells us that most people, even if they believe they need less sleep, really do need 7 to 8 hours of sleep. Now, there is some variability, and some people can thrive with a little bit less, and that's fine. But most people should really aim for that 7 to 8 hour mark, which means going to bed early enough to get that much sleep. It means shutting down computers and TVs and calming the nervous system down, not eating meals very late at night, heavy things that are going to turn on the digestive processes, which might interfere with sleep. So it's really about creating a bedroom sanctuary at night where the rest of the world is shut off, where everything gets closed down, and that there's as little light in the room as possible. And one of the big culprits of too much light are the smartphones going off all night long versus just being shut down and things like that, because we need a dark room for the biorhythms of the body to do what they're supposed to be doing, for the pineal gland to secrete an optimal amount of melatonin, and so on. So all of these things that we think about for a restful night's sleep are important, and they need to be a priority, because with the blurred boundaries of home and work, many people are bringing work into the bedroom, they're bringing other things, and the bedroom should be its own designated place to rest, recuperate, sleep. If you're fortunate enough to have someone that you go to bed with, to connect with, to just be there with, and go into a restful sleep together.
In fact, you write that something like 100 years ago, people actually slept more when there was, a less electricity, a less literally light in the world. People actually put in more hours of sleep.
They did. And they went to sleep earlier and they woke up earlier. And now some people actually wake up quite early, but go to sleep at midnight. And it's just too late. I have many colleagues who are up at 5:30 and they go to bed at 12:30. And I know it's not enough. And what it does is it slowly drags down the rest of your physiology, because you need that sleep to recuperate, to restore your physiological processes. We've seen many studies, And we've done many studies on sleep and sleep architecture and how to get the best night's sleep. We know that when people don't sleep well, that affects the rest of health and resilience. And right now, we need to be as resilient as possible. Think about what your mother or grandmother told you. I can remember my grandmother, you need your sleep.
Yeah, I remember
she didn't know all the studies that are out now, but we need our sleep.
Well, you know, we're coming up on Thanksgiving. Of course, it's tomorrow. That Thanksgiving meal, you know, heavy on carbs, if you go the traditional route. And then, of course, you feel absolutely exhausted and you want to take a nap a couple of hours later. How do you celebrate Thanksgiving? What do you eat?
So, you know, I think that an occasional indulgence is okay if you're being as good as possible. But I also know that if I go overboard, I just won't feel well. And feeling good is important to me. My brain feeling as sharp as possible is important to me. So still be moderate. Eat a little bit of the things that you've been looking forward to all year for that holiday meal. But be moderate and get some of those plants in. And if you do have a heavy meal, take a nice brisk walk afterwards. Help your body to process it. And then go back to thinking about how can you be the most nutritive, supportive, and nourishing and caring to your body afterwards.
And this Department of Integrative Medicine, it's the first in its country to be affiliated with a medical school. Do you see this then as a kind of a complement to the traditional medicine that we're used to?
It absolutely is and should be. That's how we've defined integrative medicine at Jefferson. It's meant to be a value add to the rest of the medical model and to fill that gap of how do we maximize wellness. How do we improve health status in a wellness-oriented model versus a disease-oriented model?
Well, we're going to leave it there. Dr. Daniel Monti, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It was a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome, and happy Thanksgiving to you, however you celebrate,
you.
Whatever you're going to eat. And again, Dr. Daniel Monti is founding chair of the Department of Integrative Medicine and Nutritional Sciences at Thomas Jefferson University, and again, co-author of a new book called Tapestry of Health. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, which you can get wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thanks for joining us.